On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Stephen Presley about his brand new book on cultural sanctification. So we cover all sorts of topics like, what does it even mean for the culture to be sanctified? Can Christianity coexist with paganism? Can there be peace at all? How similar are we to ancient Rome, and do we really have a problem? Who actually caused this? What are the ultimate response that Christians could potentially have to this? Can they retreat? Can they fight? Or is there something in between? And how does this cultural sanctification differ from an isolationism or from a strong confrontation? Who are some example figures who might fit this paradigm? And where does Christendom go as this ultimately develops? Do reform figures fit in here somewhere? And a ton more. It's a lot of fun. Stay for the full thing. It's full of good stuff.
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm joined alongside Hunter Heinzman, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And ever since the beginning, we've really strove to encourage serious thinking in a particular way. So it's not just, you know, be a serious thinker, but there's like certain virtues that go along with that, that makes you a quality, virtuous thinker, at least in the Christian tradition. And that's what we think you should be. And those are things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. That's not curiosity in the vice sense of just vain curiosity. It's curiosity in the interest and openness to other people and their ideas. It's supposed to be things that James 3 would encourage us to have. Sort of this open posture to others, being open to reason, being interested in other people for who they are and why they think the way they think. But that doesn't mean that we just give up all of our ideas and give up our own positions. We can still be firm in what we believe and what we confess, but we can do it in a charitable and appropriate way. And so we've tried to meld these things and encourage them, promote them, and talk about them. And hopefully, just sort of by the osmosis of culture, we begin to become more like these sorts of Christian people. We want to be distinctively Christian thinkers. Now, on the podcast today, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Stephen Presley. If you don't know Stephen and the work he's doing, you should know it. He's got a book that we're going to be talking about today that just came out in 2024 called Cultural Sanctification, Engaging the World Like the Early Church. So I'm thrilled to learn about how we should all become monks and not engage the culture in any way. I'm kidding. Or maybe we should just, you know, just become Christendom 2.0 and bring the Crusades back. Anyway, I'm having fun because I can do that with some people. Some of our guests, I don't know them very well, and so I can't poke fun. But in this case, I can, and that's enjoyable. So, Stephen, before we jump in, tell me a little bit about yourself, and maybe how long has this book project been in your mind? Like, when did that become an idea that you said, I need to write on this topic?
First of all, thank you so much, Jordan, for having me on. And Hunter, it's good to see you again. And it's good to be here. Thank you so much. Yeah, Stephen Presley. I teach, or I work full time for an organization called the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. It's a think tank housed in First Liberty Institute, which is a religious liberty law firm. And it's the educational wing. So we work with college students. We work with academics. We work with pastors that are interested in cultural engagement. And then I also continue to work at Southern Seminary. I'm an associate professor of church history, and I've worked in seminaries, worked in a couple different seminaries, worked at Southwestern for a long time, and then worked at Southern now, teaching church history and patristics in particular. And what really sent me down this road was two things. Number one, I've spent most of my career interested in the early church. I can think back to my master's degree at Dallas Seminary, where I took a church history class. And as I was raised a good Baptist kid and discovered that there are people who believed some really great things and some interesting things prior to the 20th century. And I fell in love. I started marching through the tradition, and I stopped around the fifth or sixth century and kind of fell in love with that. And, you know, the more I studied the fathers, the more I began to raise a family and think about our life today. And so this book comes at an intersection at a pivotal time, I think, in our culture, where some of the work I've done on the early church really begins to intersect with our lives in really interesting ways. And that was the motivation for writing this book, kind of marrying those two things between the ancient and the modern. And what can we resource and learn from the wisdom of the great tradition?
So I have a lot of questions about this book. I am going to start, though, with one of the questions that you seem to introduce at the beginning of the idea, can Christianity even coexist with paganism? Can there be peace between these two things, whatever we want to call them?
Yeah, I mean, along the way, I've read just extensively both modern and ancient in this sort of area. And one pretty formative book, I mention it in the book at several points, was Stephen Smith's Pagans and Christians of the City. And that book really kind of takes on that thesis and ultimately argues, you know, they can't. I think I even cited in the book where Smith is actually drawing on lectures that T.S. Eliot gave where they describe modern paganism. But Smith says something like the basic existential orientations between paganism and Christianity cannot coexist ultimately. The moral expressions cannot ultimately coexist. They may be able to produce peace. They may be able to live kind of side by side in ways. But if you think about the New Testament, you can think about Peter's injunctions, in 1 Peter, live such good lives among the pagans or among the Gentiles that they see your good works and praise the Father in heaven. So, I mean, a lot of New Testament texts are wrestling with how do we live with two competing theological and moral frameworks? And that's a struggle in the ancient world. And as you well know, and I know Hunter knows, is a struggle for our lives today as well.
Yeah. And that, I mean, how similar are our lives right now compared to what the ancient, the Roman civilization with early Christians are experiencing? It seems to me, I mean, you look across the landscape today, obviously people recognize there is some sort of problem. But how similar is that problem to past expressions? And ultimately, you know, we'll want to find out if the solution is similar to what others have experienced. So just, I want to know, like, first off, are we similar to ancient Rome?
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. And I know you and Hunter are good historians of history of Christian thought. Even if you're systematicians or philosophers or theologians, you still know the tradition well enough that the ancient world or different times and places are very different than our age. And actually, in the introduction, I talk about some of those differences. And one of the things that I have just writing this book and just thinking about is in the early church, they talk a lot about, or there's lots of discussion how Christianity was largely unknown, how they had all these misconceptions. They thought Christians were cannibals and all these kind of vicious rumors. Well, today, we don't necessarily have the problem of being unknown necessarily. Christendom has thrived in certain places and is waning in certain places. And now we're dealing with a different context in which the aftermath of the failures of institutions, or failure might be too strong, the aftermath of institutions that are shifting. So that's one of the contrasts. In some ways, our cultural engagement today may even be more complex than it was in the ancient world, dealing with technology and the realities of the complexities of the modern world. But, and Stephen Smith draws this out. I mean, Carl Truman, at the end of his book, Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, says we're living in the second century. So there's lots that are noticing these similarities. And I think the basic existential orientation, the basic moral framework, the basic theological convictions that are different from a pagan reality, a pagan understanding to Christianity, continue to be the same. And I think that we can get wisdom from the ancients in the ways they engage the world.
So Dr. Presley, what are some of the various options that you found that, I'm not going to call you Stephen. I can't. Dr. Presley is my supervisor for those who don't know in my PhD. So what are the various options that Christians have to respond in this moment? And how have the early church kind of taught you and guided you in understanding what those options are? Do we retreat? Do we take up the arms and fight? Do we, is something in between? Like, are we aspiring for Christendom 2.0? What options did you see talked about in the early church that we can learn from today?
Well, first I want to say it's a pleasure to have Hunter on here. We have had many, so many conversations about these things and about life and ministry and family and church fathers and theology. So it's a joy. And one of the challenges I found, and this goes back to sort of the motivation of writing this book, it was not too long after the Benedict Option had been written. And so in some ways, I was meeting with some publishers and they brought up the Benedict Option. They said, hey, what other, if you're going to go back to Benedict, if you're going to go back to kind of the Benedictine rule, what others can we go back to? Is sort of the rise of monasticism the only legitimate sort of expression of cultural engagement? I said, well, you know, we may want to go all the way back to the pre-Constantinian fathers that were actually living among pagans and see what they said. But in the course of writing this book, you know, the conversations have twisted and turned. And underneath all of it, I think in the times I've spoken to churches and the times I've worked with pastors, even college students, there's a lot of fear. And fear fear can be a paralyzing emotion, and fear can cause us to react in certain ways. And I say in the book, sometimes we need to maintain strong doctrinal commitments and make sure we do shore up our theological and moral frameworks. But at times we got to engage, and I'm inspired by some of the apologists of the second century that are writing letters to the emperor. Even if the emperor didn't read it, they're writing to him, you know, and they're discipling and they're catechizing and they're baptizing and they're engaging the intellectuals, the political figures. They're engaging them, not in a way that is fearful or distrustful, but they're engaging them. And so that's why I use the language cultural sanctification, because I'm trying to see the best of both of those. And I even end the book, I go to Benedict's Abbey, if you read the conclusion. The closing story is I go to Monte Cassino and I go and I sit in the Abbey and I talk about coming down from the mountain and being shocked into the reality of the buzzing Italian world below. And the challenge of actually living Christianly in a world that is often set against those things. So that's what cultural sanctification means. It's a vision of engagement that tries to draw from both maintaining strong theological convictions while simultaneously serious engagement.
So here's an interesting side question based on something you said, where the second century apologists are there writing letters to the emperor, even if they don't read them. Is there a parallel for the public intellectual today who's quote tweeting the president, knowing that the president will not read what they're saying, but they're trying to pedagogically teach others how to appropriately interact with the cultural shifting that we experience today?
You know, I hadn't thought about that, but that is a great example and shows the complexity of the modern world, where I do think there's some similar things going on today. No doubt technology has changed the way we interact, but I think one along these lines, I have a chapter, so I break it down into identity. So think about identity formation, or at least, discipleship. Then political theology and public theology. Public theology, I break into two sections, intellectual engagement and social engagement. And when you talk about intellectual engagement in terms of public witness, what I really found fascinating was, and I draw this distinction in the chapter, between what I call organic intellectuals and institutional or traditional intellectuals. The traditional intellectuals were often your philosophical traditions that had their own schools. The organic ones are the Christians who were Justin Martyr gathering with his disciples, you know, above the baths, or Origen starting a school where you're rising up and then you're critiquing, you're engaging, you're drawing on the forms and features of the culture in ways to bring awareness of Christianity. Doing so, knowing that you're probably not going to convince the philosophers, but there are a whole lot of people out there that you might persuade. And so I like that idea of an organic. And along those lines, it's like, you know, the organic intellectuals, they're not concerned that they don't have degrees from the great philosophical schools. They're not concerned. They make their arguments in the public square in order to persuade those. So I think as long as, I mean, your opening discussion about virtue, as long as you're utilizing the forms and features of technology for promotion of Christian virtue, Christian doctrine, Christian morality, and doing so in ways to persuade the audience, maybe not the president. Yeah, I can see a lot of sort of rhetorical kind of similarities.
So since we're talking about these kind of mediums in which these are happening, what kind of just riffing off where this conversation is going, what are some of the sources you found, like, where this public theology and public witness was coming out? Was it just apology letters, or was it sermons to the faithful? Like, what were the various sources that you drew upon to kind of build this vision for a public theology in the early church?
And I'd welcome your thoughts on some of this, Hunter. You're steeped in the middle of engaging these sources. So I'm going to turn it back to you in a second. But I think the one thing that I have noticed, and one of the challenges, that's why I use the language cultural in the title, is one of the challenges as I began to engage the literature from this vantage point, is you realize, both in the ancient world and today, how cultural engagement has to be holistic. Like, it can't just be, how do I live my life? It can't just be intellectual, engaging the intellectual authorities. It can't just be, how do I look at the political world? It can't just be, I'm just going to sit in my church and disciple. It's got to be all of those and more. And that's reflected in the texts that you find in the ancient world. Apologetic texts, catechetical texts, discipleship texts, sermons, a whole range. Because the problem is not just one area. The problem is a holistic. So Hunter, as you have gauged some of that apologetic literature, how has it shaped maybe some of the ways you think about ministry, or that holistic approach to ministry?
I mean, I think it just tracks exactly what you're saying. I mean, there's a variety of audiences that are in view, and you're always looking towards convincing the skeptic, you know, in a winsome type way, reaching the lost, but also forming up the catechumens, the young disciples, to equip them with the virtues and ways of thinking about truth, in which they can be faithful witnesses in their own context. So I track right along with, I mean, I know we, you know, kind of father-son type relationship in the that's what I see as well.
This is not for a grade.
You heard it here first. Hunter is a winsome promoter, so he is a Tim Keller disciple and devotee. So all of you who don't like Tim Keller, you can write him at his email.
No, yeah. I just know Hunter is steeped in ministry right now, thinking about a lot of these things. So
it's funny, you know, because Justin Martyr is such an interesting figure, but studying these guys really do help you. Just church history really does help you engage in a holistic manner and so sort all sorts of ministries. And that's what I love about this book and what your goal is in it, is equipping not just intellectuals, but pastors and church members to engage virtuously in their context. And I think virtues are such an important thing. I know Jordan has highlighted that at the beginning of this. Justin highlights virtues a lot too, if you're interested in that. But but yeah, I mean, I think that's just so important. And I guess, is cultural sanctification possible apart from virtuous living? And maybe thinking through like how the virtue ethics has been received traditionally, and maybe even the Reformation, like, do you see parallels between some Reform figures with what you're seeing in the early church? Or do you think there's a distinct witness that we can learn from in the early church that's maybe not found in other segments of the tradition?
Well, you know, I will say what makes this book kind of unique is that it is looking at a period and a time in which the church was not surrounded by a Christendom. So it's not like the post-Reformation context where you're really debating the relationship between church and state, and you're constructing sort of relation, I'm trying to understand the distinctions of some of those things in a variety of ways that different traditions have formed. And what this is, I mean, in the intellectual engagement chapter, I begin with an apologetic debate between a pagan and a Christian, where the Christian's walking along and the pagan worships an idol, and the Christian says, "Hey, you want to talk about that?" And then they launch into an intellectual debate right there. I mean, and it's a philosophical debate, it's a theological debate, it's a biblical debate. It's just and it just shows, I think, that example, that text, it's Minucius Felix's Octavius is the text, exemplifies the sort of the organic and constant kind of interactions that Christians had to live with in ways maybe later traditions aren't necessarily always thinking about. However, to your point about virtue, I think, yeah, Christian morality, as it's explained from the biblical text, has always been, even though virtues and spirituality has been understood in a variety of different ways, there's a common sort of vision that the spiritual life or holiness ought to be a distinctive feature of the Christian life.
So help me to understand sort of the middleness of this way, compared to sort of isolationism and the stronger, strong arm sort of confrontationism. Because I imagine there's quite a few of our listeners who probably look at the isolationist approach now and say, that doesn't work. And I'm not, in any way persuaded by it. And the sort of so-called middle ways that, I've poked fun at so far also seem to encourage and ultimately lead to vice. And so it seems like, well, my only option here is to be confrontational and to reclaim what is rightfully mine. Where does yours fit into that sort of those, I guess, lanes?
Yeah. I've been talking about this book with pastors or this topic with pastors. One of the challenges you find is it's easy to talk about these things in the ideal, in the sense that and it's easy to put it on Twitter and social media about how we need to do these sorts of things. But when you're a pastor at the local level, and you have a congregation staring in front of you, you have school teachers, both public and private, you have politicians, you have business workers, you have regular people who are trying to live their lives. They have jobs, they have families, some of them have their kids in public school, some of them have it in private school, some of them are homeschooled. And the reality is we cannot live in those ideals. That pastors don't have that kind of that advantage. Now, you may contend in certain communities towards one or the other, but that goes back to this issue of sort of holistic approach, is that a pastor has to be prepared often to address a whole host of issues and shepherd people that are in ways that are helpful. In the book, I use the image of improvisation. I talk about improvisation. And, that term, I got it from Sam Wells has a book on ethics as improvisation. Van Hoosier uses improvisation. There's several people that write on early church that have used the language improvisation. I'm trying because I know we can make fun of it and talk about like Michael Scott and The Office and improvisation, and it can carry kind of a negative connotation. It's certainly worthy to be critiqued. But on the other hand, for me, when I look back at the early church, it shows the immediacy of the challenge before them. I cite one text on the apostolic tradition where they're working through jobs. Like, are you a sculptor or a painter? Okay, that's great. God has gifted you. Just stop making idols. Okay? Are you an actor who does shows in the drama or the theater? Okay, well, you might have to quit that because the immorality embedded in those things is not in does not comport with Christian morality. And so there's this social kind of struggle of sifting the wheat from the tares of virtue and vice. And I think that is the challenge. I think there is a local response that we need good pastors at the local level who are shepherding their people through these specific challenges that they're facing. And I also recognize that issues are different in Texas and California and North Carolina and New York. And And so it's hard to draw some of those generalities either way. I actually think my kind of image of the spiritual life is more practical and able to address issues at the local level in ways going to those ideals doesn't.
So, Dr. Presley, I mean, it seems to be, in some sense, a work of retrieval in how we are to engage our present time. But as you read some of these apologists, I mean, like, for example, Justin, he's engaging the Platonists, he's engaging the Peripatetic, the Aristotelians, he's engaging the Stoics. He's much more skeptical of the Epicureans. He's not really kind to them at all, or the Cynics.
Yeah.
I don't think your vision is that we all become, you know, Aristotelian or engage in Aristotelians or Platonism or those kind of things. But how do we take that principle, so to speak, with the current philosophies of our day? Like, do they teach us how we should engage, like, existentialism or postmodernism? Like, I know postmodernism covers a ton of different things, but do they shape the posture for how we should engage some of the dominant philosophies in our own time?
This is a good question. So I have done some teaching every year for a few years with some missionary training at a particular missionary training institute. And all of those who are training are often going overseas to unreached people groups and groups that are not in any way distinctively Christian. And two things. One, first of all, it always amazes me at the joy when I talk to these missionaries who are going to places I'm not sure I am strong enough to go. And they're taking their families and they're going to the ends of the earth, and they're willing to sacrifice so much for the sake of the gospel. And they got joy on their face. But I also talk to them a lot about the ways to persuade those in foreign contexts, in foreign cultures, cultures that are not distinctively Christian. And one of those ways is you have to learn the patterns and the forms and the practices. You have to understand that people. So the early church, I think, implicitly had to do this in a couple ways. Number one, before I say that, this is also why catechesis and discipleship is step number one. That's part of the, I mentioned, you know, on the apostolic tradition that says catechesis was 3 years. But this is the problem. I've often used the illustration of Simon the Magician in Acts 8 with Paul and Marcel in Acts 17. The Ethiopian eunuch. The Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8. The Ethiopian eunuch has Isaiah 53 out, and he turns to Philip and goes, "Who's the person here?" And Philip goes, "Awesome, man, Jesus, let's rock and roll. Why shouldn't he be baptized?" And then you get to Acts 17, and you got Paul, and Paul's like, "All right, let's begin at ground zero. How many gods are there?" You know. And then Paul gives almost a cosmic narrative that is competing with the kinds of cosmologies and cosmogonies that you're describing in those other philosophical streams. I mean, you have to begin with, so that's what catechesis demonstrated. And several thought, I mean, Irenaeus talks about this, the conversion of Gentiles takes time because they have such a radically different view of reality. So the early church understood that catechesis was essential because I have to slowly bring them out of that embeddedness in a pagan worldview, a pagan view of reality, a pagan social imaginary, to use, you know, Charles Taylor's term. And I have to patiently guide them with a Trinitarian view of the world, with an understanding of Christology. And then I can go out. And so in the book, I describe the fathers of the church and their apologetic orientation do three things. One, they use the philosophers for the sake of evangelism, for the sake of apologetics, and for the sake of dogmatic construction. It's the third one that becomes the more problematic and the more interesting. I think this is maybe what gets some of them into trouble. But I think for us, they were trying to persuade others, drawing on the forms and features of the day. So I think you fast forward that today, we should know our culture and our context and the philosophical sort of contours of our modern world. And we are, I think, doing the same. How do we understand it? And how do we evangelize the people who share those sheer kind of modern or postmodern moral convictions? How do we persuade them? How do we show the faultiness of their philosophical system? How do we use it to actually show ours is better, the Christian vision of reality? So you have to have that framework, and then you can engage. I fear some today may go off and read philosophies and actually be persuaded by them and chase them down, which is why catechesis becomes so important, forming someone in Christian doctrine, Christian morality.
That's good stuff. So I have a question that I want to understand in large part in relation to the work, because you've mentioned at the very beginning of our interview something about the decline of institutions. Yeah. How important are institutions for cultural sanctification? And then do we need to start new ones versus reforming old ones? Is there a sort of like a turning point where, like, at some point it's just like there, you have to abandon and start something new?
And this is, I'll just do a plug for your work here at London Lyceum. I mean, I think this is a great example of a new institution that is forming, that has begun. The one thing the early church taught me, and it's the chapter on intellectual engagement, is that they realized, look, I can't join any of the philosophical schools. So Origen and others start a school in Alexandria. Justin starts a school. There's a sense in which they realize, hey, I got to build a new institution here that is not the philosophical schools. And in that chapter on intellectual engagement, I describe Origen's curriculum, which is wonderful. He has a basic curriculum for that, that's a broader, and then he has a more specialized curriculum that is specifically for, you know, the more apt, you know, with greater aptitude. And he's leading those, in part of the curriculum was what I just described a second ago, engaging the ideas of the world, engaging the philosophical tradition, showing that they've failed. And I left that, you know, we're reading a book here in the center I work for called Mission Drift. I know it's been a popular book, but it's a book about trying to maintain the identity of institutions. And it goes, of course, back to the Ivies. I've been on Harvard's campus recently, and I stood in front of the Johnson Gate, where the Massachusetts Bay Colony founded, you know, the charter for Harvard. And I've stared at it. And you know, that's just an easy example. But there's a whole host of nonprofits, of institutions that were founded to provide all kinds of social services that were originally distinctively Christian. And the problem is the Christian character of so many institutions no longer drives those institutions. And culture, I think culture is formed through institutions. So, but to your question, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. At some point, we need to work to redeem old institutions. And at some point, institutions cannot be redeemed. We need to start new ones, and we need to encourage those new institutions. So I'd welcome your thoughts. What are your thoughts on these things, Jordan?
Well, I am by no means the authority on this, but I won't decline an opportunity to spitball here. And so I think that the new institutions, when to start them, one of them is just, is there an opportunity to do so? And if the opportunity is there, say you don't have the ability to engage or reform an old institution, so it's not for a lack of trying, it's just you don't have the opportunity, and you've been given funding or resources or a group of people who are willing and ready to start something new, and there's just a gap, so you do it. But then there's obviously the other perspective of you're at a legacy institution, and either you have worked for, you know, a long time to try to reform it, and there's just no going back, the inertia is too strong, or something like that. Or the methods that would be necessary to be employed to turn it around would ultimately compromise your Christian convictions. And that seems to me another reason that you would say, all right, I'm giving up here. I do think there's a place for people to stick it out and to not reform an old institution. There's value in those people. So I don't think it's just everybody like deplete and leave the old institutions that are decaying and that are dead and that are ultimately going to die. I think there's a value there, but I think there's also value for the sort of the visionaries and the people who have the skills and the ability to create things and to do things to say, no, you need to go do something, create something, cast a vision, build something, and gather people around you to create something that's useful and that can serve, instead of being stuck in the dead end place where you're spinning your wheels and you're ultimately not seeing the fruit that you could see otherwise.
Yeah.
It seems to me that's case by case, and you have to know a lot of details to really make that decision.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's one right call on it, but I do think there's a lot of value in, if you have an opportunity to start something, you should.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen it happen here at the center I work for. We do a lot of work with undergrads and working with getting undergrads into various academic programs, graduate programs, doctoral programs, in a whole host of fields, the humanities. And so, you know, part of that vision, I've wrestled with this even at the, you know, at the personal level. I've seen great students go off to a whole variety of them, but I've also seen, like you're saying, the benefit of even pastors working in churches, trying to revive churches or start new churches, or, you know, a whole host. I think that's the point. And that's part of the thesis of the book, Cultural Sanctification, is it's not a one size fit all. I think there is a complexity in taking it on a case by case basis. That is how we can continue to see the people of God flourish, even though sort of the mores of the culture are going in ways or becoming more diverse in ways that don't reflect a unified Christian vision.
So as we think about institutions, and I'm also interested in the churches, the early church's view, but also a contemporary application, what kind of relationship should these institutions have to local churches? I know there's a semi-push to pushing these, you know, institutions, like maybe we don't need institutions, maybe this should all be accomplished by the church. And then second question, in our current context, what possibility do institutions have for Catholicity with other denominations as well? So twofold question, what's the relationship of institutions to the local church, and what's their potential for greater expressions of Catholicity?
Writing this book, on the first question, one of the outcomes of it and what I'm thinking about now is how important the church is. I mean, you can create all the institutions you want, but without a healthy church, I mean, it's almost like curing the symptoms without curing the actual cause, you know? That is a challenge here. And I think that goes back to that first chapter on identity and catechesis, is it's discipling and training strong pastors, strong churches. And then, yeah, let's start all kinds of parachurch organizations, academic organizations, social organizations. But all of that stems from a rootedness. And in some ways, one thing I love about reading these early Christian documents is how small the church was, and yet how confident they were that God was at work among them. You know, it's like you're living in the second century when Gibbons, you know, he says this is the height of Rome. And the church is like, yeah, I mean, you know, you got something like the Epistle of Diognetus that I cite in the introduction. It's like, yeah, we're the soul of the world. Like, think of it, like, whoa, like we're the ones that God is at work in. And it's just like shocking to think, or, you know, Polycarp standing before the proconsul there, and he like quotes, yeah, if you want to know Christianity, name a time and we'll go hang out and I'll talk about it. But, you know, if not, Christ is going to come again in glory, judge the living and the dead, and establish a kingdom that will have no end. And so the church has like this, even though it's small, has a very strong sense of the Lord is at work in the church. So that's today, I think, one of the challenges that we have is continuing to maintain strong churches. Simultaneous to that, you don't have to watch the news very long to realize denominations are waning and changing. A book I cite in my book is Nonverts, The Rise of Ex-Christian America, that kind of walks through the rise of what he calls nonverts, Stephen Bullivant. That is not just the percentage of the nuns, those who have left all religious conviction, but the nonverts are the percentage of the nuns who were in a Christian tradition but are no longer. They have deconverted. They're nonverts. And 44% of 18 to 29-year-olds are nuns, and a significant percentage of that, 70%, if I remember right, 70% of those nuns are nonverts. They were in a church and have left a church. And I think what it's going to require is a new sense of cooperation. I've really, really challenged for this. Among churches, among denominations, among groups, I'm actually concerned that the growing churches right now seem to be non-denominational churches, which are growing. And one of the concerns I have is, are non-denominational churches willing to cooperate? Denominations have cooperative sort of infrastructures, whether you're Lutheran or you're Presbyterian or you're Baptist. So I think what lurks on the other side is not only strong churches, but churches willing to cooperate to provide the moral fabric of the culture.
So somewhat of a follow-up question to this on the relationship between the local church and a sort of an institution that's not the local church. I think there's probably a strong impulse in certain segments of evangelicalism to say parachurch organizations, institutions are either unnecessary in total, or they have to have some sort of like very clear hierarchical, the local church is the authority over this institution, and there's a clear dotted line here. In what sense does the early church, like, where does the sort of like the structural piece go? Are the institutions free floating? Are they somehow underneath the authority of a local church or a region or an association of churches? How does that sort of work out?
That's a good question. I think in the modern period, it's much more complex than it was in the early church. I think I use the case of Origen. I mean, Origen obviously got in trouble with his bishop in Alexandria, and actually he ended up leaving, went to Caesarea later. So I don't know exactly. I'd have to think about sort of the structures of let's say the way sort of social institutions, if we can even call them that. The church was really, in the early church, the church was really kind of the locus of all of that activity. But I will say today, those supportive parachurch organizations ought to have a good, healthy, and close relationship with the church, often fulfilling the things that the church may not be able to do exclusively because of its size or its location or that sort of thing. So whatever the case, I think goes back to my earlier point, the church is the family of God and the locus of God's redemption. So every parachurch organization must see itself in, I think, a secondary sense as supporting, as helping, as guiding. Now, issues of oversight or that sort of thing, I'm not sure exactly how that needs to play out in a general sense.
So here's another question on just our public witness in general. How much do the early church fathers think we should care about that? There's questions today of, there's almost like differing approaches to what it means to be a Christian in our culture, where some will say, I don't care about what a pagan thinks about me in any sense. I'm going to tell them that they're a sinner and they need to repent, and that's all there is to it. And then you have others who are going to want to say, well, I want to sort of like win their confidence and their trust, and then make an appeal based on a relationship and a friendship. So I want to care about what other people think about me. I want to care that the pagans think well of me. I want outsiders to think well of me. How is the local church in the early church thinking about those sort of questions?
This is a great question. And one of the challenges we have is we have New Testament injunctions for both of those things, right? I mean, that's the challenge, is we have, we have a text like 1 Peter, live such good lives that they see your good deeds and they praise the Father in heaven. Be peaceable, and so you have these injunctions, and yet, just walk through Acts. I mean, they are engaged. They are confronting. They are addressing. I'm not going to be like Hunter and use the language winsome. I won't do that. So, but one of the challenges is, and this is what I've seen writing the book and thinking about this, talking with pastors, working. We are not living in a world where Christian morality provides the moral framework of the social world. We're not living in that world anymore. It is diverse. We have a range of options. That being the case, as you live your life, you will, as a matter of principle, have to interact with a whole range of moral positions. And thinking through that, that's now the responsibility of pastors. And I think one of the challenges we face now is having to think about that public theology or that public life and the way the Christian morality intersects with all kinds of a diversity of moral views. I will say a couple things. One, what did I learn from the early church is the importance of persuasion as a posture. And so wisdom and persuasion. Some of the most important texts in the early church are the wisdom literature. So what is Proverbs? I mean, Proverbs is all about like business and family. And they would look to the Proverbs. They would also look to the examples, of course, the example of Christ, but the examples of the great saints of the Old Testament, the patriarchs, the prophets, to look to the model of a spiritual life that is lived within the public square. And it's not always a one-size-fits-all. I mean, we hash out on Twitter how to respond to everything. And sometimes there's good advice. Sometimes there's not so good advice. And to go back to a comment, I think we need pastors now more than ever. We need wise, godly, virtuous pastors who love their people, who are in their lives, who are helping them work through every little scenario of their life in the public square. We can't fall back on our laurels and assume that our public witness is, and assume that the world in which we live is Christian, and we can just kind of coast along. This importance of the spiritual life is, and the importance of persuasion and wisdom.
So would Origen or Justin Martyr, if they were faced with the election of 2024, vote for Donald Trump or Joe Biden or somebody else?
I have no idea what Origen would think about something like that. It's a great question. I mean, I think I'll say this. I do have a chapter on political theology. And I will say what's interesting. I talk about I do think the problem is living in a pagan world. You have to think about political power. And you have to read Romans 13 and 1 Peter, fear God, honor the king. And what do you do when the emperor is not a virtuous person? And, you know, I have a whole chapter on political theology from the early church. And I begin the chapter with Polycarp. You know, it's really interesting. Polycarp is staring at a proconsul who's about to take his life. And he quotes Romans 13. He said, as we have been taught. And then quotes Romans 13 and says, you know, God has granted you an authority for a certain purpose, as long as you do us no harm. And so there's sort of an optimism about political power. And there's an optimism about God's transcendence, God's providential rule and reign. There's an optimism that God has orchestrated these events for a particular purpose. And there is what I call an active citizenship. They're active within the public square. So, you know, some of those things, I think, guide their view of the political realm and their view of politics that set it in a certain context and set it in under the banner of God's general and providential activity in the world. So I don't know if they'd vote for Trump. I don't know how they would vote. But I do think whatever they did, they would walk to it with a vision that this is God's world, that we are his children, and that God is active in the world.
Good answer. I could keep you on the hot seat if I wanted to. I've got other hot seat questions. Maybe I institute this in our podcast episodes. At the end, we have the hot seat. And we can ask all the fun questions that everybody wants to ask and get answers to. Yep. But then no one would want to be interviewed anymore. So.
That's right.
Well, remind me, for those who are interested in following along with your work, where's the best place to go to keep up with what you're working on?
Most of what I'm doing, I post on my social media accounts, but the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy is often publishing stuff that the center's working on, that I'm working on. A lot of my work is coming out in a couple different outlets, so Religion Unplugged and several other places like that. But social media is probably the easiest way to track what I'm working on.
Awesome. Hunter, is there any last words that you want to share before we end?
I just want to thank you, Dr. Presley, for being on. He models what he's talking about in this book, both at school and just in other avenues that I've seen him to live and work out. So just grateful for you and your witness. I do think you're carrying the torch forward in many ways. And many of us are appreciative of that as well. What other books you got coming out? You got one coming on theological interpretation, right?
I do. I just submitted the manuscript to Baker for a book. The title is Biblical Theology in the Life of the Early Church, Recovering an Ancient Vision. And I call it the prequel. I'm calling it the prequel to cultural sanctification. It's the way the early fathers envisioned, the way the Bible shaped their theological vision of the world, and the way they read scripture in a way that guided their cultural sanctification. So that should be coming out around this time next year.
That's awesome. Very exciting. Well, Stephen, we really appreciate you coming on to talk about the book. I encourage you all who are listening to go buy a copy of it. I'll put a link in the show notes. As you know, we interview a lot of people who write really expensive books. This is not the really expensive book, so you can go afford it and still have food on the table tonight. So I encourage you to pick it up, support Stephen, and then learn, engage it, think about it with your church, and really apply it to your own life. And if you can't tell, I mean, there's what better testimony to Stephen's character than to have Hunter here and to be sharing all the good things that Stephen does. And the fact that Stephen puts up with Hunter is all the more reason to think that he's a great guy that you should listen to. So we thank you, Stephen, for taking the time with us. This has been a lot of fun. Everybody who's been tuning in, we appreciate you all listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.